This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Charlotte City Manager releases his budget proposing more spending, but no increase in property taxes. CMS has been busy explaining its proposed student assignment plan to parents, even as a bill that would allow Matthews and Mint Hill to operate their own charter schools moves to the General Assembly. Federal Budget Director Mick Mulvaney's South Carolina House seat is up for grabs, with a primary looming for the Republican candidates, and opponents of the I-77 toll roads lose a court appeal. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. Tom Bullock is here from WFAE's newsroom. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Doss Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, has returned along with Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. Let's see if you can tell them apart. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Glenn Berkins.
I'm Ann.
And Glenn Berkins, the editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com, is also here. Good morning to you.
Thank you.
You can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks using the hashtag WFAE Roundup. Well, Charlotte's relatively new city manager, Marcus Jones, released his first budget, his proposed budget. One of the features, as I said, is an increase in spending without an increase in property taxes. So what would the spending be on? Tom?
Unfortunately, it's not spending on me, but I appreciate the sentiment. Well, the usual stuff you would expect for city government. The increase, and there is a 5.3% increase, which is significant, focuses on some key areas. And Marcus Jones, in laying out both his PowerPoint and the presentation before city council, really said that, look, he's new to Charlotte, so what he used as his guiding principles was this letter that the city council released after in the aftermath of the Keith Lamont Scott protests. And they focus on police accountability and police number of cops on the beat, affordable housing.
Good jobs.
Yeah, which are all things that you would hope a city budget could actually focus on.
Yeah, that letter to the community written after the Keith Scott protest, they pledged to improve police accountability and the department's relationship with the community. Does this budget do that, or does it simply add officers?
The latter, yes.
And remember, the officers, and I'll just interrupt Tom for a second here, the officers are part of a two-year plan that was already in motion. There were 63 officers, I think, last year, 62 this. Would that make 125 with my Louisiana math? I hope it does.
I think so, yeah.
So that satisfies what Kerr Putney had asked for, the police chief, but it does not take care of the other part, which is being debated with the Citizens Review Board, which is separate from the budget.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, pointing out that it's an odd thing that Marcus Jones did there in pointing out police accountability as a core function of this, because there's no way you get to that in a budget.
Right.
Unless you're suddenly going to spend city money to establish projectors on the sides of buildings where you could view, say, police body camera footage. It's just not going to happen. Mm. But it does go through some key points. I mean, the affordable housing front to me was particularly interesting, because not only is the city getting more money to try to build affordable housing units, they're actually accelerating the pace at which they want their goal to be met. It was originally 5,000 units in 5 years. They're already a third of the way there. They're looking to get these 5,000 more affordable housing units in Charlotte in the next 3 years. So that is an increase in both priority and fund.
And they get $15 million put into the Housing Trust Fund every couple of years. And this budget calls for what, an additional $2 million?
Correct. That's right.
How will that help them reach that goal sooner? The $2 million, when you compare it to $15 million, it's a drop in the bucket, isn't it?
Well,
it's supplemental.
Supplemental.
That's the best way to look at it. Instead of getting $15 million over a couple of years, you're getting at least $17 million. So it is an increase.
You're accelerating your pace.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what they're trying to do. And remember, I think Tom or Glenn or Ann, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe that when the letter came out after the protests, that letter was council-specific and very much apart from Mayor Jennifer Roberts. Not that she's against those things, but it very much stood alone.
Well, and in her State of the City address, she talked about having paid family leave for city employees, and that's not in this budget.
Yes, and Marcus Jones, when he was asked about it, said that they still have to review it, that there are some complications in terms of family leave, so we'll see if that actually ends up happening in the near future.
Glenn. Going back to the area of police community relations, while a large segment of our population probably would not see it this way, I think we have to realize that there is a segment of our population that doesn't necessarily equate more police officers with greater community relations. Mm-hmm. So, just getting back to that, it will be interesting to see how they're able to fulfill that part of that commitment. As it was correctly said here, this budget does not do it, and simply adding police officers on the street in some parts of our community, that is not seen as something that's going to necessarily build trust.
They're adding 25 support staff, too, through this infusion of money, I suppose, if the budget is passed. Would the support staff be community relations, or are they supporting internal operations?
They're supporting internal operations. As I mentioned before, I've been at a couple of the meetings where they've talked about the Citizens Review Board, and that seems to be where I guess the possibility, but also the difficulty of addressing this issue of transparency lies.
Absolutely.
What's the makeup of the board? What power do they have? How do they interact with the police force and the city? That's really where the rubber meets the road, and there aren't any real clear answers so far to that.
And in fact, Raleigh is stepping in here and diminishing things that could be done by the Citizens Review Board here in Charlotte. Take my example earlier about police body camera, you know, the bill that's making its way through the General Assembly now, make sure that citizens review boards cannot see police body camera footage unless they somehow obtain a court order. And that was a change from original text, or at least original concept of that bill. City council members, I believe, can, yes, but they have to swear basically that they won't leak. They have to, you know, sign a confidentiality agreement, literally, before they can see it. And that is still, you know, we were all told that the body cameras in particular were going to be the way to do what Glenn is talking about. It's not just more cops on the beat. It's accountability for those cops,
yeah, right,
through transparency.
And remember, this is going to be, we're obviously in an election year. This is going to be really big on the Democratic side, because Mayor Roberts, for example, if we recall last September, said no, we should not release the video. Then, yes, we should release the video. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Chief Putney said, no, we shouldn't. So this is all going to swirl into the debate with Joel Ford.
What we've seen with body cam video is that it doesn't always answer the questions.
Right.
But knowing that it's there and you can't see it, and or the people who can see it can't talk about it, will almost certainly increase distrust.
And what's the thought process behind not allowing the Citizens Review Board to see the video?
It goes back to leaks. I mean, literally, as the debate was happening, people were talking in a committee. They were talking about the fear of information being leaked to the public or the press.
And I think it goes to a mindset of, does all authority rest with the police? And essentially, these citizens should have very minimal ability to oversee them, versus we know we're asking police to do a really important, literally put their lives on the line task. But we are going to have somebody who has some power to call them out when they
Don't
do
something.
Well, and I think
this is such an interesting debate, because for the Carrick case, for example, we wanted to see the video. This is not, obviously, I'm not arguing against transparency, so let me be clear about that. But a lot of times, once you see the video, it's still very much like a Rorschach test. I mean, it
raises more questions than
it answers. Really does. That doesn't mean they shouldn't be available, but it's a complicated issue.
I think rarely do police videos alone answer questions, because there's always what happened right before that, and that's usually the point that they raise. But going back to what Ann said, I agree completely. I think the reason that they don't want the Citizens Review Boards to view these things is simply political. We have a General Assembly that's run by Republicans. They're very much pro law enforcement. They want to do everything they can to protect law enforcement, and I think this is what we're seeing.
But when you keep something secret from a child, that makes them want to see or what do or whatever it is you said, no, you can't do that, or you can't know this. They want to do it because you said no.
A child or a reporter?
is there a difference?
I think that's human nature. So right. What you just said, Ann, was that these videos do not necessarily tell the whole story, and they don't. And the average person thinks about these videos as being a Hollywood production.
Exactly.
Everything's been staged. All the angles are right. We'll see precisely what happens.
You'll even have the musical cues to tell you who's the good guy and the bad guy.
But the more that you see these, the more that you will realize, well, it doesn't tell the whole story. So the clamor will die down. If you keep it away from people, the clamor will rise.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, you sort of drown in ambiguity when these videos come out, but that doesn't mean they shouldn't, because at least you get a little more perspective. And I think, to Glenn's point, you're trying to put together an entire picture, and that's part of the picture. It's not the answer, but it's part of the picture.
And seeing the chaos in the video in some ways helps us understand why in some cases, eyewitness statements, even from police officers, can also be less than perfect because it's not this sitting there watching a film. It's a huge amount of tension and adrenaline, and you're focused on one thing but not the other thing. You know, we saw that with the uprising and the street chaos in September. There were thousands of different viewpoints, and they were all different.
So we saw it this week in Texas, in the Texas case, where the officer initially said that the young man he shot, a 15-year-old, that the car was backing toward officer in a very very aggressive manner. Once the video was viewed, it showed just the opposite, that the car was going away and that he fired into this occupied vehicle.
So if you're just joining us, it's clear that we're talking about the city's proposed budget. So let's get back to that.
Oh, yeah, that thing.
That's right. It does. It does include $1.5 million more for the fire department. It's also a part of this is a new ladder company near Eastland Mall, which kind of maybe I just don't understand fire departments, but why do they need a ladder company in an area where it's all two or three story buildings?
Well, you still got to get up to that third story. They've got a roof, Mike.
we don't discriminate by venue in terms of
is this something CMPD has been asking for?
Charlotte Fire.
Yes,
CMFD.
And honestly, let's also, I mean, we're kind of making some jokes at the former Eastland Mall, but realistically, if everything works to plan, the city is hoping there's going to be something more than a couple stories in that spot at some time in the future.
What's interesting to me is that is what's funding this thing, this apartment boom.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, everywhere you go in the city, whether it's down South Boulevard or up Tryon along the light rail, just about everywhere, these apartments are just everywhere. And I guess this is the upside of that. Yeah. We're not going to have to pay higher property taxes.
But there is – I mean, and here are the stats that they actually put in the presentation. Over the last 5 years, 11 million new square feet of commercial real estate, like commercial space – on top of obviously what already existed, 24,000 new multifamily units, those are apartment units normally, that Charlotte is growing by an estimated or on average about 44 people per day.
Right.
It's significant, and that does lead to you know, a nice chunk of change for the city through fees and taxes and anticipated property
which
taxes.
Which has allowed them to do all the things we've been talking about, plus set aside $8.5 million for economic development projects. What kind of projects are they talking about?
They never talk about those in public.
Right? You don't know until they finalize what is coming or what they've attracted.
Public-private partnerships that we're talking about here.
Think more along the lines of Company X is thinking about moving headquarters or
tax incentives.
Right,
tax
incentives. Yes.
The budget does call for us, however, to pay more for water and garbage collection. The average increase, I think, is $21 a year in water bills and $6 more for garbage.
And water not based on volume. That was an interesting change. Usually, it's based on volume. This is just set fee, part of the set fee.
Yeah, and part of that, though, is, if I remember right, part of that is there's a cycle when it comes to the infrastructure that makes our water go through our pipes, the pumps, the reservoirs, the filters, those kinds of things. And they're starting to cycle out, so they need to buy replacements. But, you know, the interesting thing here is this is and you're exactly right about the numbers, Mike. $21 a year for every resident, regardless of economic ability to pay. So this is inherently a regressive tax that will hit poor Charlotte harder than it hits wealthier Charlotte.
We have to take a break, and when we come back, there's more CMS news. CMS is quickly becoming the new HB2 of this program. We will come back and talk about that and other things as well. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members in Carolina Tree Care, providing residential and commercial general tree care, specializing in tree health care services. Carolina Tree Care's passion is to maintain and care for the canopy of the Carolinas. Information at carolinatreecare.com. And Charlotte Mecklenburg Stormwater Services Big Spring Clean on Saturday, May 13th, seeking volunteers to remove litter from creeks. Info at stormwater.charmec.org. Next, in our ongoing Block by Block series, we explore one of Charlotte's oldest and most charming neighborhoods, Plaza Midwood. The Thirsty Beaver, a tiny bar on Central Avenue, has become the poster child for what happens when mega development mixes with funky neighborhood charm. And guest host Tara DeLeo will explore how neighborhoods like Plaza Midwood preserve the character that made them popular in the first place. That's on this program Monday at 9.
I'm Tom Asbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, another attempt to replace Obamacare, James Comey in the hot seat, Hillary Clinton on why she lost. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Stay tuned for On Point as the news roundup continues following Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Glenn Birkins is here from Q-City Metro. Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. And Tom Bullock representing WFAE News. And Ann Doss Helms is here. She's the education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And CMS has been out for the last several weeks explaining and answering questions about Superintendent Ann Clark's proposed student assignment plan, which we talked about a lot in recent programs, in advance of a school board vote, which is looming large. You took a deep dive, Ann, into this plan in the pages of The Observer, and one of the goals was to break up extreme pockets of poverty in this plan. You found that that's underwhelming, in fact, in this proposed plan. Talk about that.
Well, when we were here, I think last Thursday, we had two education reporters and two school board members, and we were all really kind of struggling to say, what does this mean? Because we had seen sort of this almost a data dump, you know, it was their best effort at describing it. But, and Erica Ellis Stewart said what had been presented to all of us, which is 21 schools see an improvement in diversity. And we were trying to figure out what that meant. And in a lot of cases, what that meant was really relatively small changes. For instance, a school that would go from, you know, 53% to 45% medium SES, socioeconomic status, which is their new measures. Like, what does that mean? So I looked at the schools that were in there that had at least 70% low socioeconomic status, which is sort of basically your high poverty schools, which is the ones where they're saying this is the real challenge. This is where conditions are bad for students and for teachers and for learning. Mm-hmm. And out of those, there were only 7 that saw a significant change in their significant reduction in poverty.
So let's do a quick rundown of numbers here. There are 170 or so schools in the system.
Right.
This plan would impact 75, but only 21 of those 75 would see improvement in diversity. And in fact, only 7 schools that were rated as low socioeconomically would see any significant drop in those poverty levels. So was this a deliberate backing away from the goal when they looked at things and thought, oh my gosh, we can't do this, we'll have to do this?
Well, I think there were two things going on, and one was that there was not a strong consensus on the board to take bolder steps, because that would have been very unpopular. And that's the second part of it, which is even bigger, is how do you do it?
Yeah.
And you may recall on that Thursday show, I asked Erica Ellis Stewart, who has been one of the strongest, most forceful voices for doing more to reduce poverty levels and to equalize opportunities for the black and brown and impoverished kids in those schools. And she kind of deflected. She said, we can't just move kids around. We've got to do other things. Well, we all know that. That is 100% true. But nobody has really laid out a plan for how we could have significantly reduced poverty at, you know, it's more than 70
schools
that have very high concentrations.
Is it even possible to do, unless we go back to what we were doing before the court order ceased being in effect and bust people all around?
Well, you can't do that, though. I mean, but
that's why I'm asking.
Yeah,
is it even possible to do unless you do
difficult.
That?
You could, if the political will was there, they could choose to just say socioeconomic status is going to be our driving factor and we are going to do whatever it takes to balance it. Whether that would accomplish anything positive is a really huge question, because would the schools get any better?
So you could split it, as long as you didn't say you were doing it on the basis of race,
exactly.
You could do it. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I was responding to the literal question.
Politically,
correct.
It is, you know, and you would also have a lot of people.
Position, but the trick here is still the fact that, you know, we're talking about busing after basically, you know, continued segregation in our schools. Well, schools are no longer legally, officially segregated, but they are de facto segregated based on neighborhoods. And it always has confounded me with this plan, which if you're really trying to stick to neighborhood schools, but you're trying to break up pockets of poverty,
you can't.
Without the buses.
Well, and buses. We had this debate. Mike, you were here. Several others were here as well. In 1999, when the Potter case was decided, there were plenty of people who said, this is going to take us down the road of resegregation, and it has.
And you go on to say that racial isolation that is found in so many of our resegregated schools remains unchanged in the plan. Mm. So, given all the things you've discovered, why do it?
You know, and I think that's going to be, there's always sort of the, you need to do some cleanup every few years. And some of this, it's like West Charlotte High. That was one of the things, you see several boundary changes for West Charlotte High. And one of the things I was wondering is, are we going to see a really different West Charlotte High School that is somehow more diverse? And in fact, they moved a lot of these boundaries around, and what you see is still a very high poverty West Charlotte High School. So I think some neighborhoods are being moved to closer schools. Some are happy with it. Mm-hmm. Some, we heard from the Montclair neighborhood on your show last Thursday. They're still 10 miles away from a high school that they don't want to go to. They're kind of upset that they didn't get a change. So again, the goal was never just to increase diversity. It was also to keep schools close to home and to do some other things that would make this a little more sensible plan. So I think what they'd say is we balanced all four of those as best we could.
And on the other side of this, you discovered that there are several schools that that have pockets of affluence.
Yes.
And they are not impacted by this plan at all, by design or oversight.
Well, again, they tend to be neighborhood schools where you have concentrations of affluence, and they certainly tend to be politically empowered. We heard some concern about Providence High School was going to lose some students. They were one of the few schools that was not touched at all. You do have Huff High, which is one of the more affluent high schools. And I think Tom said at the last show that he's actually in that chunk that's being moved from Huff to Hopewell.
Absolutely.
And
he's a senior.
Yeah.
Rising senior.
Well, he's in his 10th year as a senior, but yes.
Still rising.
But Ann, isn't this, again, aren't we getting into a lack of political and public will? That's what we're talking about in terms of trying to get better balance, right?
It's a lack of political will in terms of the school board, but it's also a lack of political will on a broader basis, too.
The public.
Until we do something to address housing patterns, until mm-hmm. we're willing to allow low and moderate income houses in places where we don't want them now,
right,
we're going to continue to wrestle with this.
Right.
That's exactly the point I made with the buses. It right now physically is about the only way you could actually do this unless we do exactly what Glenn was saying. I mean, that's the key. And there is no political will on that at the moment. I also want to ask one thing, Ann, because one thing that hit me, and speaking of Hopewell, part of this seems to be just trying to, and it makes sense in a way, like trying to better utilize underutilized schools.
That is part of it.
Is that a bigger segment? Are there more schools that are affected that way over in terms of overpopulated, underpopulated than there was to the seven that you found in terms of socioeconomic? You may not have done that look yet. I was just curious.
I have not, but that's definitely part of what they're doing. And again, when it gets to some of the areas that were not touched a lot, like the south part of Charlotte, they're saying, we didn't want to shuffle a lot of students because we want to build a new high school down there, so why do it, you know, do it now and then do it 2 or 3 years later? I think another interesting dynamic of all this that we haven't discussed a lot but that's out there in the community is these state letter grades, mm-hmm. which are based on performance on exams. And so you hear a lot of people talking about going from an A school to a C school or a D school. And that feels very comfortable because, you know, who wants to go to an inferior school? What those grades really tend to reflect is demographics to a large extent. You know, an A school is almost always a school with very low poverty levels and large concentrations of white students. And an F school is almost always your most urban, high poverty, resegregated school.
So when those letter grades are given out to those schools, what are they grading? Student performance, the teacher performance, a combination of both?
Student performance, and it's a combination of how many of them are proficient or how many get a grade level score, and to a lesser extent, how much progress they show year to year.
So if you are a person who's suddenly assigned to an F letter grade school, but you come from an affluent family, it doesn't mean your child is suddenly going to be failing out of school. It just means they're actually going to help to raise the average, raise the letter grade of that school. Right?
That would be one way of looking at it, yeah. And it's especially when you see the difference between a B and a C school, mm-hmm. it's usually, it does not mean, in none of these cases does it mean you have horrible teachers there.
Here's one thing that's fascinating to me, Mike, and Ann, I love that explanation. It's something I really haven't heard before. But why is it that we aren't hearing CMS explain these things more in depth? They've spent so much on the why they're doing this that they have done very little, at least in my opinion, to start explaining the how it will work and what these things really mean. Getting into that, I think, is what parents – and I'm a parent – I would like to know more about, and it's fascinating to hear you talk about this because I'm not hearing that.
So did you go to the community meeting for the,
I had to work.
And
so
actually, that's the thing. I have not been going to them because I would have to be 10 people and work every night to get to all these meetings. They really are doing a lot of get out into the neighborhood, you know, even doing follow-up. If a PTA says we're, you know, I think the Moorhead STEM, we talked about that as a really popular magnet school that's proposed to see some significant changes. They're going back and looping back. So maybe they're doing some of this on the one-on-one situations. And they are doing a lot of this. They're streaming most of their meetings on Facebook Live, which I think is a great idea because if you can't drive to the meeting because you're taking care of your little kids, you can maybe, you know, click on your laptop.
And when you were here that Thursday when they released this plan, you talked about you wished that there had been a way to dive down into the maps electronically on the Internet. And have they not offered maps on the Internet to show you how this works?
I think it was about a week after the thing.
How do parents get access to that map, to those maps?
Well, unless it's changed this morning, and that was one of the things, because I had to email them and say, when is this coming? And they said, our favorite response, it's on our website. And I told Ann Clark, if I had this material, it would be the minute you click to the CMS website, you would see a link to that. In fact, you have to click on the student assignment button, which is in yellow on the top, and then you have to start kind of reading through the fine print on their itemized, and then you find a little link that says.
So we've asked the schools over the years to do a lot of work on fixing society's problems, and you point out that in an age where we have CMS magnets and charter schools and private schools, there's a limit to how much impact you can have with boundary changes because, you know, affluent parents will simply say, well, no, I'm not doing that. I'll put my kid in private school or I'll go to this charter school. So is the time for social engineering by the public schools over?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think a lot of people would say yes. I think you talked about the, if you don't do this our way, we're going to leave CMS. I think you're going to hear a lot of this on Tuesday, which is the public hearing. And I think a lot of people who don't like this are going to be signing up to let them know. And I think I would bet that you would hear over and over again, if you do this to our neighborhood's gone from Charlotte Mecklenburg.
You know, it's interesting because we had the whole Economic Mobility Task Force, what was that, a month or so ago? And this was a big part of the conversation that you can't, as Mike is saying, you can't just put all of this in the lap of the school system and expect it to be fixed. And also to what you're saying, Glenn, that as long as you have housing policies that have basically no intermingling, for lack of a better term, how in the world are you going to begin to balance this?
And the frustrating cycle here is it is so slow to change housing patterns. And, you know, we've seen this every time we talk about, you know, the city talking about housing policy. And we feel like Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools doesn't move fast enough, but they're going at lightning speed compared to housing trends. But you're right, you can't just expect them to wave the wand and shuffle the kids and expect everybody to be okay with
it. We also don't yet know, I believe, what this plan is going to cost because Ann Clark's going to let people know about that, I think, this coming week. Why would this plan be more costly than what's going on right now?
Transportation is a big thing. This relies heavily on magnet programs. A lot of these attempts to make schools more economically diverse rely on putting a partial magnet into a school and saying, if we're offering this, people from various neighborhoods will come. That is not a guarantee by a long shot. Some of these may fall flat. But if they do accept that, busing for choice is very expensive, much more so than sort of what we think of as busing. So transportation is big. These magnet programs, if you just put a label on the school, which has sometimes been the Charlotte Mecklenburg School's default, you know, make it look like we're fixing things. We're going to call this the Academy of Excellence or something. So if these magnets are real, they require recruiting and training teachers who are very skilled in these specialized subjects.
Because we already, I think, drive enough miles that all of our school buses could go to California and back every day. Every day.
That's Ann's statistic, I believe.
Yeah, but it is. I'd forgotten it, but it's a good one.
So
I think that was just the additional miles, maybe.
So will the school board will vote on this plan on May 24th. Will they have time to do a cost-benefit analysis of the plan between now and then once the figures are released sometime next week?
Well, you've got a lot of parents who are saying no. And saying they really need to delay, they ought to delay until November, get the new superintendent in office, get the school board election out of the way. I think a lot of people would be tremendously frustrated if after 2 years they said, let's drag this out a little more. I mean, it's kind of the trade-off of a finite number of people who are upset now versus if you throw it all up in the air, everybody's worrying about what might happen to them.
So as you said, I think it was last week, that really the only person who knows everything about this plan would be Ann Clark and her immediate staff, because they worked so long and so hard on this plan. But the plan might be passed, but with alterations, is that right? Could that happen?
Yes. On Tuesday, they are also supposed to report out, you know, they've been having these meetings, school board members have been hearing, I cannot imagine how much from their constituents. So if you have five board members that are going to Ann Clark and saying, whatever, you know, this paired elementary school plan,
right,
it sounded great to you, we're not going to vote for it, then they're going to come out with an alternative proposal.
You asked, is this, these elementary school pairings, is this new and innovative, or is it a throwback to the 1970s? What's the answer?
A little of both. Paired elementary schools were part of the court-ordered desegregation plan in the 70s. They were at that point based very much on balancing the race, and it might be a school, you know, that's 10 miles away from another school. But this idea that you would have one united group of kids that goes to one school for K-2 and another school for 3-5 has been done. The ones where they're doing this, and in particular the two neighborhood school pairings, they happen to be adjacent to each other, they happen to have dramatically different socioeconomic status, and they have different building utilization. I hate that word, but I had to use it. You know, one school that is extremely crowded next to a school that is underfilled. So they accomplish a whole lot of things by merging the districts.
So all of this is going on, even as a bill is making its way through the General Assembly that would allow Matthews and Mint Hill to operate their own charter schools. And we've talked about this before, about how this might be viewed as a trial balloon for breaking up CMS. Is that what it is, and where does that bill stand today in the legislature?
Well, to clarify, it would not be seen as a trial balloon for officially breaking up CMS. There is another bill that's still alive in the General Assembly that launches a –
But if you suddenly let towns around Charlotte
I know it sounds like I'm splitting hairs here, but I'm not. Officially, charter schools are still public schools. The money gets pulled away in a different direction, but they are, in fact, still charter schools, and by my understanding – they would still be considered CMS schools.
But most charter schools are run by –
No, they wouldn't. I'm sorry. You're right.
Most charter schools are run by private entrepreneurs, and this would be run by the town of Matthews and by the town of Mint Hill.
And they would have the ability to do something that they cannot now, which is give their own residents – preferred entry into that charter. That is the key difference.
That's huge because that gets you around basically the CMS assignment.
I actually think, Mike, that this answers your question you asked earlier about is it time to say enough with the social engineering?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is, because there are too many other alternatives now between charter schools, private schools. This trend is going to continue not just in Charlotte. It's going to continue nationwide. And I just don't think in an age of choice, and that is what we have now more and more with public schools, parents are not going to sit still, affluent parents in particular, and middle-class parents. They're not going to sit
still. So where does that leave the lower-income parents who don't have those choices?
They have to figure out how to get on the bus with everyone else. I think the African-American community, the lower-income parents, they've got to figure out how to make these charter systems, how to make these various choices work for them.
Okay, when we come back, we'll talk about the special election in South Carolina and the fact that I-77 toll road opponents have lost again in the courts and the virtual meeting that took place yesterday. We'll actually talk about it. Not virtually, we'll actually do it when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Doctors Making House Calls. Physician-owned and managed, Doctors Making House Calls works to help complex patients stay healthy at home and avoid unnecessary ER visits and hospitalizations. Details available at doctorsmakinghousecalls.com. And H&S Roofing and Gutter Company, providing roofing and gutter services for residential and commercial customers in the Carolinas since 1939. More information at hsroofing.com. Republicans celebrate the House passing an Affordable Care Act repeal, but Senate victory is certainly not assured. The FBI director is in the hot seat about the pre-election investigation into Hillary Clinton, who talked more this week about why she lost to Donald Trump. Just a couple of things they'll be talking about as the weekly news roundup continues, the national and international segment On Point with Tom Ashbrook coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. And we will continue here in just a moment.
Hi, I'm Kelly McEvers, host of All Things Considered. My first car was a 1975 MG Midget. It was this little tiny orange sports car. It was actually my mom's car, but when I turned 16, they offered the car to me. 4 days later, I got in a terrible accident and wrecked it just to pieces. Even that car could be turned into my favorite programs.
Find out more at WFAE.org. Click on the support tab for info.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the weekly news roundup, the local news roundup with Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, Glenn Birkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com, and Andos Helms from the Charlotte Observer today. In South Carolina, South Carolina's 5th District Republican Congressman Mick Mulvaney vacated that seat to become President Trump's budget director. They're having a special election to replace him in June, June 20th, but they've already held a primary, and a runoff is coming up on May 16th, at least on the Republican side. Democrat Archie Parnell easily won the right to represent his party in the special election. So is this runoff, who's running in the Republican runoff? That's the question.
So we had, what, 7 Republicans, and the 2 that emerged were Tommy Pope and Ralph Norman. They were both right around 30%, which I think would logically lead us to think this will be a pretty close.
And one of them left their seat in the legislature in South Carolina.
Ralph Norman did, yes, okay. Correct.
Why were they the top vote getters? Do we know?
Because people like them more.
Thank you for that insightful analysis.
He took that right out of my mouth.
Thank you.
I can speak less about Norman. Tommy Pope was the solicitor there. He grew up there, went to high school there. He's been around as long as I can remember.
Still in the South Carolina House, Speaker Pro Tem.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Look, these two, my joke aside, these two were – Tommy Pope was clearly the front runner going into this race. And, well-known in York County, well-known throughout the 5th Congressional. He's a well-known commodity. So is Ralph Norman. He also was in, as you said, the state legislature. Right. He also comes from a family that's really well-known. He's a property developer down there. Okay. And I think the thing that was more interesting about the results is, if my memory serves, it was only 118 votes that separated Tommy Pope from Ralph Norman. So that's a whole lot closer than I think some people certainly expected.
And Archie Parnell will be the Democratic candidate in June. Who is he?
Now, this is fascinating. So his main opponent was Alexis Frank. She's 26 years old. She's a veteran, stay-at-home mom, just got a master's certificate, a complete political newbie. And she basically ran more or less as kind of the Bernie Sanders millennial candidate. And she garnered 26% of the vote, which is not – that's still pretty good, especially in the 5th. I mean, granted, it was a partisan election. But – Archie Parnell keeps saying that he is pretty much the only Democrat that can solve the riddle of how to take South Carolina's 5th back for the Democrats. It was a long Democratic seat.
Yeah, Congressman John Spratt held it for years.
Yeah, and he lost to Mulvaney in 2010 in the great Tea Party wave.
Right.
Archie Parnell is he's got some legal – or not legal. He's got some political experience, but not as an elected official. He worked for House Ways and Means Committee for a long time. He is a former tax expert with Goldman Sachs. That's not something that you would normally hear or expect to hear with the Democrats these days.
Right. And of course, this whole – election will become all the more interesting based on what happened in Washington yesterday.
Well, actually, before we go there, what we can't skip over is who didn't win, Sherry Few.
Yes.
Right. She was perhaps the most interesting candidate in that race. Mm-hmm. She basically ran waving the Confederate flag, criticizing her opponents for allowing the flag to be taken off the candidate. She was in some ways, Confederate flag aside, she was in some ways kind of the Donald Trump candidate, very much on the attack against her Republican opponents. She ended up getting only 5% of the vote, and that surprised me. She Sherry Few got very few votes.
So could that, so could that be an indication that the Democrats have a shot, that the old maybe the old thing, hot buttons, don't work anymore in the 5th, and maybe it'll go back to
Well, I think any time you're right about Sherry Few, although I think Ralph Norman could probably take the Trump mantle as well, because he also went after Tommy Pope really heavily on Facebook. Just a lot of criticism. But no one went after their opponents like, you're right, Sherry Few did. You know, it is an uphill battle. It is potentially doable. I mean, look, if you look at the congressional seats in Kansas, where a Democrat barely lost despite really any national support. If you look at Georgia, which has turned into the most expensive House race in American history, and they have an open primary system, so the candidates, regardless of party, are all on the same ballot. And you have, in a longtime Republican stronghold district, you had the top vote getter, a Democrat.
Yeah, and Gingrich's old district.
Exactly. And you look here, they really have to go after the moderates. And that's what Archie Parnell has been saying the whole time. He is absolutely fine with saying he's about, you know, changing tax policy. He doesn't mind saying he's from Goldman Sachs by any stretch, because he sees himself as being to market himself as a different kind of Democrat. And to Glenn's point, or Eric's point, actually, yeah, I do think that is legitimate. You're talking about the House passing the replacement for Obamacare, and that will
– it's a huge factor.
If it starts to translate from sticking it to Barack Obama, yay, to
– to populist anger
away my health insurance, seriously? You know, I think that national scene will very much affect local races.
This is going to be the first real test after that House vote.
Yeah.
How much backlash there might
be. Why do you suppose there was such a disconnect? I mean, all of a sudden people are realizing this is about them. It's not about Barack Obama. It's about them.
Well, President Barack Obama took a lot of heat for that. I mean, he actually said we did a really bad job explaining this thing to the public.
Yeah, but if you never had health insurance before, or if your child had a pre-existing condition,
well,
and now you can get it, why didn't you make that leap?
But Republicans messaged it really well.
Yeah, they did.
A lot of people who weren't following this closely, and let's face it, how many people really closely follow federal health care policy, believe that Obamacare was a handout to the freeloaders.
Meanwhile,
their health insurance was something different.
This may not pass the Senate, as it was said many times yesterday, but if it does, let's just say it does, how can Republicans really seriously not realize that if you take somebody's health care away and they need it, and suddenly they're facing bankruptcy because their health condition is no longer covered, that's not going to have a reaction in the polls.
Well, I think that's why the party's so roiled. I mean, that, you know, you saw a little bit of a pushback, obviously, in the House, but in the Senate, I mean, the Senate Republicans have been much more skeptical, to put it mildly. The other thing is, it's when you take something away from someone that you get the visceral reaction. And so that's the answer on health care and why this is
exploding
now.
And we elected a president who believes that you can just tell people what they want to hear. I mean, he keeps telling people, mandated that we won't take away pre-existing coverage. You know, this is going to be great.
Yesterday, he used – I mean, they're just factually wrong when you say that the healthcare costs have gone up faster. The rise in medical costs have been lower than they have in decades since this plan was approved.
Which is why the American Hospital Association doesn't like this new plan. Well, the I-77 toll road opponents have suffered another setback. They keep striking out. Most recently, the State Court of Appeals upheld a previous ruling that the project is constitutional. So this is a decision, a unanimous decision by a 3-judge panel. Is that it? Have all the possible attempts at stopping this gone away now?
Well, Kurt Noss from Y977 spoke with WFAE's David Borax and said, we're going to take a look here to see what other options are open. I mean, if anything, I think the anti-I-77 toll lane folks have shown they are very resourceful and they are very persistent.
Yeah, they're 2 years into their court fights and still not giving up.
But as of right now, at least on this path, doesn't mean they can't find another path, it does not look promising yet.
Duke Energy yesterday held an online, virtual, first ever, for them at least, shareholders meeting, but it did not stop demonstrators from protesting outside the building, although we don't know where the shareholders meeting originated from, what television studio it came from. First, why was the meeting virtual? And second, what were the demonstrators protesting?
Well, the first part, more and more companies are actually doing this, and I think one of the obvious answers is they don't want that kind of parade going on when they're being protested over whatever it is. We've had Bank of America with investing in coal. We've had, obviously, Duke Energy with coal and other coal ash and other things. And so companies would rather skip that headache. So that's why I think you're just going to see more of this. But it's been done plenty of places.
Yeah, and look at, Wells Fargo. they had theirs on the 25th, and you had protesters being escorted out and shouting down. And this does create a buffer.
Can you get into these meetings if you're not a shareholder?
Well, officially, no, but you can simply buy a share, one share will
let
you
in. So won't that happen? If you move this thing online and it's open to questions, et cetera, online, you just buy a share and you get the password and you get to
– No. That is such a – No. Here's how it works. They pre-screen the questions, or you could submit a question by pushing a button on the website.
That seems fair.
And we've been kind of ripping on this, but we should hear the company side of this. Specifically, what Duke Energy said is by going online, by making this more interactive, it allows shareholders, more people to take part. Right. In theory, that is absolutely fair. But
I think the reasonable answer here is that you do both. That you're online and everyone has access, and you still have a physical meeting that people can go to. I think that's probably, in terms of transparency and accountability, the best answer, but that doesn't mean that companies are going to do
that. And you do have to wonder, if the virtual meeting becomes the norm, do the hackers start moving in? Does that become the new way to disrupt a shareholder's meeting?
But I do have to say, like, what you basically just described there reminds me of the movie, what is it, V for Vendetta? I have to say, too, it's one thing to hold a virtual meeting. You know, we're talking about the benefits and detriments of that. But there's another thing where you literally put in this random cloak and dagger stuff of we're coming to you from an undisclosed location, sitting in front of a random blue curtain. It just seems like you can say, you know, we're in Charlotte. It just seemed a little bizarre to me.
So how many protesters showed up? Do we know? I read the article in the papers where I couldn't find a number. Do we know?
I don't know.
It looked like it was kind of the usual crowd. This was actually – that used to be one of the benefits of our old building at the Observer. You'd walk in and you'd see the protest, and it was good street theater. And it would usually be, you know, what, 30, 40 people.
Yeah.
It's not a huge crowd. This is not the Women's March or something. It is a very dedicated group. You know, they had the huge papier-mâché head of Lynn Good, you know, enacting their version of the shareholders' meeting.
Okay. Governor Roy Cooper came to town this week to outline his economic philosophy to business leaders, and he told them, the leaders, to tell legislators to abandon their plans for a tax cut and instead invest in education at all levels. How was that received?
Well, no one openly hissed, but I, you know.
Well, at least not in the room.
Not in the room. That to me is fascinating. He did this on the campaign trail a lot, too. It's fascinating to me that Roy Cooper, and I guess business leaders have said to him, I'm sure they have, that educated workforce, skilled workforce is the most important thing.
Yeah.
However, I think that translating that into a mass movement of business leaders going to legislators and saying, please don't cut my taxes again, that is just a really, really difficult thing to do. I mean, maybe it happens, but I'm very skeptical, and I'm even more skeptical that Phil Berger and Tim Moore, among others, would listen. On the positive side for Governor Cooper, he did talk a lot about working with the Republican legislators on economic development, on things like incentives, on going after a so-called mega site, you know, large-scale manufacturing company. So it seems like he at least is able to, as he put it, compartmentalize in some areas where they can work together. Now, on the taxes, I'm going back to that one. I just don't see how that's going to fly.
And I read the article in the Charlotte Business Journal, and the headline was, the governor said that the state's economy is ready to take off, but I couldn't find that anywhere in the article. So did he in fact say that?
Yeah,
or
he did. Yeah. He did in fact say
and
that.
And that's based on what?
His
HB2 being over.
His, that's funny. Yes, he did. you can trust me. He did say it's ready to take off. Basically, what he was talking about is the structure. I won't drag you through all of it, but the structure of economic development, because there is a private group that Governor McCrory formed that works with the Commerce Department. And Governor Cooper thought about getting rid of that altogether. He's since decided to keep it, but he says they are working much more compatibly with him in office.
Meanwhile, the state is back in the headlines. Slate magazine ripped into the North Carolina General Assembly this week for a descent into madness. That's their quote. An example of Republican shenanigans that should terrify us, they say, saying that America could be like North Carolina by 2020, quote, yikes, unquote. That is if
Did Trump, that appear in the story, Mike?
Yes. That is if Trump
– I believe it was only in the headline.
That is if Trump and congressional Republicans concede. So what did Slate find so embarrassing or disturbing about Raleigh?
It was pretty much the same litany of things that we talk about on this show every Friday.
Slate, if you're listening, you can quote us directly.
What all was it? The punishing sanctuary cities, the gerrymandering, environmental relaxing environmental regulations,
who's on the judiciary?
The judiciary, yeah.
Well, and the big thing that they're talking about is the fact that the votes, the raw votes, are pretty even between Republicans and Democrats, and yet you have a legislature that's 60% Republican on both sides, and you have 10 of the 13 congressional seats are Republican. That's really the nub of the issue.
And that when you start undoing checks and balances, there's nothing to check the side that's in right. power from doing its most extreme thing.
Because they said that bills passed in Raleigh could permanently damage the state's courts, elections, universities, and the environment. Permanently damage? Really?
Well, go back. First of all, I'm going to say this. It's an entertaining read, but it's clearly a read that has a very particular political point of view. I think a lot of times when you read an article like that, you forget that, yes, to Slate, this state, it can be considered a laughingstock because of policies. But to others in whose favorite political color is red, North Carolina can be seen as a model, and that's the difference here. I do think,
well, and that's what they were pointing out, though.
Yeah, well, but let's face it, they were
in a very
partisan way.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's one of the things that's interesting to me. Well, fair enough. North Carolina really is a testbed for a lot of ideas in the Republican playbook. I mean, if you take President Donald Trump's tax plan, I mean, the one sheet that we were allowed to see with the bullet points, it looks almost identical to what's happening here in North Carolina. You know, cutting corporate taxes, cutting income taxes. If you cut it, they will come, you know, the land of the Laffer curve. It has worked in North Carolina, although we don't see, you know, it may have a direct link, it may not. In a place like Kansas, it failed. So North Carolina is an easy place to point to if you're looking for, red state playbooks.
Slate should know that we are ready to take off. Tom Bullock here from WFAE News, and Doss Helms from The Observer, Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you all for the hour.